Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Let me just jump right in and introduce the panel, and then we'll get going. To my far left is Theda Scotchpole. Theda is the Victor S. Thomas Professor of Government and Sociology at Harvard. She's also been the director of the Center for American Political Studies and dean of the School of Arts and Sciences at Harvard.
Back to the Graduate School of Arts.
My apologies. Yeah. She's a past president of the American Political Science Association, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, has received numerous awards and honors, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and the Woodrow Wilson Foundation Award, given for the best book of the year on government, politics, or international affairs. That went for her book, Protecting Soldiers and Mothers, The Political Origins of Social Policy in the United States. That is only one of many books of which she is the author or the editor. Others include Boomerang, Health Reform, and the Turn Against Government, and Inequality and American Democracy, What We Know and What We Need to Learn. She also writes widely in the press, including blogging on Talking Points Memo, a website with which many of you may be familiar. To my immediate left is Kathleen Parker, who is a columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. Her column now appears in more than 350 newspapers. In 1993, she received the H.L. Mencken Award, which is given for distinguished writing. In the words of the judges, she received the award for, quote, attacking ignorance and stupidity with vividness and originality. Although she is often seen as a conservative, she wrote a much-discussed column last year in which she urged Governor Palin to step down from the Republican ticket. I read somewhere, and she can tell us later if this is true, I guess I read somewhere that generated 11,000 responses. 20,000. All right.
Yeah.
Presumably many of them using language we can't repeat.
Not nice.
Yeah. Kathleen has written for many publications, including the Weekly Standard and Time. She's on the board of contributors of USA Today. She's been a regular guest on the Chris Matthews Show. She's also the author of a book that was published last year, Save the Males, Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care.
It is a funny book.
To my immediate right is Maria Echaveste, who served in many positions in the Clinton administration, initially as administrator of the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division, later as director of public liaison at the White House, and then finally from 1998 until the end of the Clinton administration as deputy chief of staff to the president. In that role, she had oversight responsibility for many of President Clinton's domestic policy initiatives, including education, civil rights, and immigration issues, among others. Since leaving the White House, she has joined our Berkeley Law School, of which she is a distinguished alumna, I might add. She has joined the Berkeley Law School as a lecturer in residence. She's also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. She co-founded the Nueva Vista Group, a consulting firm with clients both in the corporate and the nonprofit world. She serves as a frequent guest on the PBS program To the Contrary, and she is a member of the Democratic National Committee, in fact, of the Executive Committee of the Democratic National Committee, and of course, as serving on the DNC makes her one of the much-discussed superdelegates. To my far right is David Frum, an author and journalist with a history of both working within the conservative movement and critiquing it. He is the author of 5 books, the most recent of which is Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. His past books include The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush, and An End to Evil, What's Next in the War on Terror, which was co-authored with Richard Perle. In 2001 and 2002, he served as a speechwriter to President George W. Bush. He is currently a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He also, by my count, correct me if I'm wrong, writes 3 weekly columns.
And I edit a daily blog.
And I was just going to say that he is the founder and the creator and editor of a new blog called newmajority.com, a collection of both political news and commentary, the slogan of which is, borrowing from the subtitle of your recent book, Building a Conservatism That Can Win Again. So, a very distinguished panel this year. Let's start, I think, before we get to Obama as president, let's start by talking about how Obama got to be president and talk a little bit about the 08 election. And I'll turn first to Theda, although, as always in this event, as I told you earlier, I want all of you to just jump in and not stand on ceremony. But Theda, what was the What did this election mean? What did this 2008 election mean? An affirmation of Obama, a rejection of McCain or of Bush? Was there an ideological shift here? What do you think it meant?
You know, I tell my students that they're lucky because they're living through what will prove to be, in one or many ways, one of the watershed elections in American history. It's pretty obvious that it's extraordinary that an African American, and perhaps even more extraordinary, the son of a foreign student, was elected president of the United States, signaling a new attitude, I think, on race and on our relationship to the rest of the world. It's also possible that this will turn out to be that beast that political scientists have been hunting my entire life, a realigning election. Although we don't know about realigning elections simply from what happens on election night. We did see a Democrat here, probably any Democrat who would have won the nomination under the circumstances of the economic meltdown. He won a decisive victory. And it was an election in which there's a pretty clear break by the majority of the American citizenry outside the Deep South with the direction of foreign policy and economic policy under the Republicans and under former President Bush. But we won't know if this is going to be an opportunity that Obama and the Democrats can build on to create a sustained majority until we see how he does in getting his agenda through and how the economy and the world respond, part of which is not under the control of any president. The final thing I want to just mention briefly, though, is I think this is quite a remarkable election for the methods of mobilization that were used by the Obama campaign, both to win the nomination in a very tough competition with Hillary Clinton. In many ways, that was the most riveting drama of the election, and to build a commanding majority with some new population groups, including Latinos, states in the Upper South. I would say that for the first time, we saw a Democrat marry the new technologies of fundraising and communication to a remarkable grassroots face-to-face effort across virtually all of the 50 states. We've seen something like that from conservatives in the recent decades, but this is the first time we really saw that in a Democratic presidential campaign, and it was not just a big victory in terms of the aggregate numbers. It was a startling victory that involved young people, Latinos, a mobilization of the African-American population to a higher level, an overall turnout, and a lot of face-to-face contacting that creates something Democrats can build on if they're able, and that's a big if.
Kathleen, can Democrats build on this?
We'll see, but I want to jump back and answer the original question because I think I have a perspective that is a little bit more on the ground in that place called the South where I live. I live in South Carolina when I'm not in Washington. I divide my time, as they say. But I think this was a very important turning point for this country. And I think I witnessed it on the ground in South Carolina. And let me just explain it this way. I cannot tell you the number of people who would come up to me and say, "Don't tell anyone, but I'm voting for Obama." Or, I couldn't let this be known at work, but I'm voting for Obama. And these were people who had always voted Republican, at least since the 80s. Everybody used to be a Democrat once upon a time in South Carolina. But here's what I think happened. First of all, I don't think anyone could have beaten Obama. It was just his time. It was the time for this particular individual. People were ready for the change. Where McCain appeared chaotic, Obama appeared calm. But something else happened when on the hustings, people in my part of the country saw something they didn't want to be a part of, something that was quite ugly. And unfortunately, Sarah Palin was the person that the Republican Party put out front in a skirt, winking, and said, and sort of started building this idea of Obama as being this other kind of exotic creature. And basically, it's called race baiting. And it was sexualized in the person of Sarah Palin. And I think for a lot of people, they saw that, and the scales fell from their eyes, and they said, whatever that is, I cannot be a part of that. And they walked away. So in a sense, at least from that little small part of the country and that one little scenario, I think it represents a real shift. And I think people saw things for the first time that they hadn't quite noticed before. And they might have been able to wink and nod and look the other way or avert their gaze. But when you make a direct play toward those darker parts of people's hearts, and when you see that for what it is, you have to make a choice. And I think that's what happened in part.
Maria?
I would just, both to the original question and to what was just said, I actually think this election and the primary leading up to it, I think, will be the subject of dissertations for at least another decade or more. Because there's just so much in terms of having a woman running, it's African American, it's just generational, it just goes on and on. But I think one thing, at least September, October of 2008, was that the economic crisis was such that for a number of people in the middle, race just didn't become the issue. They didn't have the luxury to focus on race and really sort of peel back and it's like, okay, what is this election about? What is it that I care about? And who is talking about those issues to me? So I think that is just something that's, as I said, we're going to study this for a long time. But the second thing is, I'm not so sure that it was as historic in the alignment way as we might, as some might want, and the realignment and sort of liberal, conservative. And that's based on the following, that notwithstanding the longest election cycle ever, 2 years, at the end, after you tallied up the votes, it was about 52%, 51%. It wasn't 70% turnout of those eligible and registered to vote. And I'm looking at the political science.
It was the largest turnout since 1964.
In numbers. But not in percentage. What I'm basing it on is the state of Ohio. And I've seen some numbers that in Ohio, which was, you'll recall, fought over 2004, the actual number of votes cast were fewer in 2008. A number of people who voted in 2004 didn't come out to vote in 2008, and lots of new people came out to vote. And so there's something about the new people coming out to vote and other people deciding not to come out to vote. And the question is, will in 2012, will you have a different group of people coming out?
Well, but this percentage of the population, it was.
Yes, but the question is, will those young people come out to vote in 2010? When the congressionals come up, when historically a president's party loses, we can have a great discussion about what that means.
But the point is, this may be a sort of one-time Obama phenomenon in a certain sense, in your view.
I think there are lots of things that have to go right to make sure that this is the kind of realignment that some people are looking for.
Of course.
David, what did the election mean?
Let me propose we take a long view and look at the series of elections that begins 20 years ago with the election of 1988. In 1988, the Republicans win a third presidential term in a row, a remarkable achievement, and they win it quite decisively, 53-46. That Republican victory rested on, it was the second last great triumph, the next was 1994, of the Nixon Reagan coalition. And that was a coalition based on building together the traditional Republican strength in the educated middle and upper middle class, and adding to it a new base in what you can call, for lack of a better term, the working class, especially Northern Catholic, Southern Protestants. In 1988, according to the exit polls, which are not always perfectly reliable, the elder Bush beat Michael Dukakis in a whole series of categories, but the one I suggest we pay most attention, and it's interesting to people in the room, was among people with 4 years of higher education. According to the New York Times exit poll, the elder Bush beat Dukakis in that category by 25 points. Over the next 20 years, what we will see is the Republicans increasing their majority among their traditional, among that Nixon-Reagan working class base, to the point where they're getting over 60% of it, at the same time as their majorities among that four-year educated group dwindle. They drop from 88 to 92, although those people go not to Clinton but to Perot. They don't come back in 1996, although Dole still wins among people with 4 years of higher education in 1996. George Bush wins in that group, but much more narrowly in 2000. He barely holds on in 2004. In 2008, that group goes slightly for Barack Obama. Even if you look only at whites with 4 years of higher education, John McCain does win that group, but very narrowly, by just a couple of points. And that is a group that is remarkably fast growing. As recently as 1990, only about one out of five American whites had a four-year degree. Today, almost one in three does. There's a lot of attention in American politics to the bottom third of the electorate. I think that there are many reasons why we pay attention to that. Part of it is this very dramatic mass migration we've had from south of the border primarily. But I think there's another reason, which is that the party that has been becoming stronger and stronger and stronger, the Democratic Party, does not like to look in the mirror and understand the reasons for its success. It is very important for the Democratic self-image, for Democrats to believe that they owe their triumphs in recent years to their ability to pull out greater support among minorities and among the young. And they have done well. But the truly decisive fact since 1988 is the migration of the upper fifth of the American electorate, not unanimously, but disproportionately, from the Republicans to the Democrats. Now, that raises that's what's happened. Now, what does it mean? The most important question for Democrats is, can they hold that new educated voting base they have? Now, that educated voting base has moved from Republicans to Democrats for a constellation of reasons, but they can be summarized, I think, in this way. In the 1990s, Bill Clinton transformed the Democratic identity on economics from being the old party of unions and protectionism and a backward-looking, nostalgic view of the American economy, the way they were in 1984 when Walter Mondale mocked the idea that the American economy could be based on silly things like software. Real countries made, steel. That Clinton modernized the Democratic approach on economics and made the Democratic Party acceptable to people who worked in the private productive economy. And then in the later part of the 1990s, the Republicans then drove that group away, partly by the social issues, partly by the Iraq misadventure, and partly because of the poor performance of the American economy for most people, not just in the crisis of 2007 and 2008, but pretty consistently through the Bush years. So that's the Democratic opportunity. The question is, having now gained the benefit of this opportunity, can Democrats use it? It seems to me that they have an option. They have a possibility of creating a truly realigning majority. But to do that, they would have to impose tremendous self-discipline on themselves. That is, to reaffirm the economics of the Clinton years and to jettison many of the approaches that Barack Obama has already legislated. What I think is the most interesting question is Barack Obama and today's Democrats are using their victory to try to do a much more ambitious, much more statist, much more redistributive agenda than Bill Clinton ever did. And we will see how that new cohort of Democratic voters responds. Let me say one last sentence because I've already gone on too long. There are a couple of ways to simplify a little bit, to think about the way public opinion works in a democracy. One model is the public makes up its mind, and then there's an election, and the election reflects what the public wants, and that means that politicians have a mandate. Another way to think of it is that elections create opportunities for political leadership. That in 1980, the public rejects what the Democrats had been doing since the middle 1960s, and in 2008, the electorate rejects what the Republicans have been doing since the early 1980s. That's an opportunity. Now the question is, how do you use it? If you use it successfully, if you deliver results, then you get ratified. It's the ratifying election that is the one that is truly important. If, however, you deliver bad results, you do not get ratified, and then all the work up to that point goes for naught. So that's the question mark, I think, hanging over what happens in the next 4 years.
And would the ratifying election be 2010 or 2012?
It'll be both 2010 and 2012.
And presumably 2016, potentially,
yeah,
and onward.
And for the current president and the ambitious agenda he's put forward, I think we'll all be watching 2010 and 2012 as some indicator. Because I think I agree that the elections is more of an opportunity. Leaders assume a mantle of mandate. Some do anyway. But it isn't necessarily the case that the American public is voting for all of the things that the president...
Well, there aren't very many presidents who have come to the presidency with as profound a set of failures and voter repudiations behind them as Barack Obama has. And in a moment of very unsettled domestic and foreign circumstances... And David is right that the migration of the higher educated, particularly in the coastal states, is a major part of what's happened to Democrats. It's a mistake not to realize that many working class people are people of color in this society now, and they are voting for the Democrats and turning out in higher ranks.
If this election had been among whites only, John McCain would have won.
But barely. All parties in America face a dilemma of bridging divides. The Democrats certainly face that. But I don't think there's any evidence in the public opinion so far or the voter behavior so far that people don't want fairly bold action on things like health care reform. So the idea that Obama could ratify this opportunity by acting like Bill Clinton in 1992 strikes me as really strange and not good advice for the Democrats to follow. Do they have to thread the needle about responding to a changing economy? Yes, but I think Obama, through all of this, before and after the election, has talked about this as a changing economy where we can't just recapitulate the strengths of the past. We've got to invest in new industries.
I'm not in the business of offering advice to Democrats, obviously.
Yes, you were.
No, I'm offering an assessment that we can see the crucial decisions of the Obama presidency have already been made. We have this big stimulus package. That's done. We have the TARP. That's done. We have the mortgage bailout. That's nearly done. And then we have the extraordinary surge in governmental expenditure. Looming over the horizon are cap and trade and health care.
Not that extraordinary, really, David. Come on.
What we are going to see is over the next few years, a doubling of the national debt in relation to national income. And that's assuming that Obama's income numbers are good. It could be more than a doubling. Now, Those things are going to have consequences for the way the American economy works. We're going to come out of the first Obama administration, probably with a surge of economic activity, because these Keynesian measures do work in the short term, as Richard Nixon proved when he did them in the early 1970s. You can stimulate an economy out of recession that way. At the same time, you have a higher debt load. We are probably going to have a much more regulated economy, and we are going to have a much higher level of much bigger government, and therefore the implication of much higher taxes in the future. He will not be able to fund this state the way he's saying he's going to. So that is going to be a very different set of economic organization. Now, if that works, if that new way of economic organization delivers enduring prosperity, well, then you guys were right all along. If, however, it has the same consequences that it usually has had in history, then it's not going to work. And then we are going to see...
And what would those consequences be?
Slow down.
The greatest prosperity in American history between the 1940s and the early 1960s, when tax rates were far above what anybody is talking about now.
The usual consequences of rapid increases in government expenditure, which we didn't have between the 1940s and the 1960s.
We certainly did.
No, we had. Between 1945
you
and
you can have your opinions, but you can't have.
In 1945, the government spent 50%.
Let him finish, and then, we'll go back.
In 1945, the government spent half the GDP. Right? In 1960,
we're talking about peacetime expenditures. They grew
well, 1945.
In the post-war
if you want to say you were comparing 45 to 65, we're looking at the chart. You can't say that government expenditure went up between 45 and 65.
Anybody can play those games.
It's not a game.
It's
a line
of war
to
a peacetime.
Sorry,
Wait a minute. All right, time out between the two of you. Time out between the two of you. Do you want to get in on this before I go on? Then I want to go on to something else. But if you want to, or Kathleen,
I would just want to urge the audience that this battle about the budget and the deficit and is one worthy of its own panel and actually a whole class, semester or more. And it can't be summed up in the rapid fire because there are real, real differences of views in both parties what the facts are and what you conclude from those facts. I think all I will say is that in 1993, when Clinton was trying to pass what he thought was an ambitious budget and the battle was between let's cut the deficit or increase spending, and the deficit cutters won, which only Democrats barely passed by one vote, and there was a huge dispute as to whether
And the major initiatives failed.
Can I go back actually to one other thing? Unless you want.
Let's do go back.
Okay, let me go back to one thing, because one of the things that I noticed that all of you talked about in this election is, maybe with the exception of you, Kathleen, is that I think all of you are saying that the election was decided, as I think most presidential elections are, by the underlying factors of whether it's David's long-term shift in educated voters, whether it's the economy being in crisis in the fall, and that therefore, for all of Barack Obama's personal popularity, for all that his personal story represents something ennobling or inspiring, that do you all agree probably any reasonable Democrat would have beaten any reasonable Republican?
Oh, I don't know.
No?
The sentiment was so fiercely anti-Bush that there was a good shot for somebody with charm and charisma and intelligence. That didn't come out right. Obama has that.
All of which he has.
He does. He does, and he's articulate, and he was a change, and I think that was a big part of it. But I wanted to say one thing about David's point about how whether the Republicans can bring back the educated class. And I would suggest that I'm going to now give Republicans some advice, and that is quit playing stupid.
Yeah. Not with what they're doing now. They're not going to bring it back.
Well, it's beyond that. It's this whole populist drive against the intellectual class, against elitists and elitism. I love elites, and conservatives love elites when it comes to the U.S. Marine Corps or the Navy SEALs, but for some reason we don't like academic elites. I hate elitism. I hate the attitude that somehow we're better than someone else because we've had good fortune in our lives and we've been lucky and we've had access to education and so on and so forth. But the Republicans have taken to playing on that resentment toward people who've got them dang PhDs, And
there's an anti-intellectualism to
exactly.
the conservative
movement. Dang is Southern for the F word, by the way.
There was also something in what David said about one in three whites being having college educations and the race piece to it. So I don't want to let go of that and just make this point, which is the lovely media in the election. I basically call them the hated media, but when you're in the White House, you just basically don't like them. But there was a real focus in the couple weeks after the election about where whites voted and had whites, he got less percentage, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, I think it misses the point, which is this country is in fact demographically diverse. And it means that the most elections from here on out, people, to be elected president, you're going to have to talk to a number of different groups to get that majority, to get you in the White House, and frankly, to get you in the Senate, or to get you in the House of Representatives.
Absolutely.
And that is something, from what the way I look at it is, because we're reaching a point in which we will have no one majority, you really perhaps have an opportunity to cut across and really look at what do people fundamentally care about. On the other hand, I simply will point out that the state of California is my poster child for how we have completely failed to see the common interest in our insistence that we will not invest in our future workforce and instead build prisons. But that's another conversation.
That's on to the governor's race rather than the presidential race.
I don't think we should leave McCain entirely out of this. And I know you were getting at this in your question. I do think that any articulate, convincing Democrat would have won in the circumstances that prevailed after the economic collapse that occurred in the early fall. But this was a much more commanding victory than I think it had to be. And I think it was not just that Obama came across as likable, calm, in command to the American people, principally through the debates, by the way, which people watched very carefully. But I also think McCain blew it in terms of what he could have done. He made the Palin gamble, which was inauthentic and came across as inauthentic, and all the political science research show cost him a lot in terms of his chances of living. But he also didn't square the internal contradictions he was dealing with inside the Republican Party. He needed to play to the independents in the middle. And that's a dilemma for the Republicans now. Once a party gets to be a regional minority party, and this happened to Democrats in earlier eras, they're tempted to play to their safe seats, to their most extreme partisans, and they start doing truly bizarre things. And of course I'm a Democrat. But I wish we had a credible alternative party. And I don't understand what those folks are doing. They're doing some very, very strange things. I mean, having the governor of Texas talking about secession? I mean, come on. That's not the way to get to a revived... And they're not listening to you.
David would agree. They want him to read
Rush
his
Limbaugh.
But that's what David's trying to do. I mean, David is one of several apostates.
They're not going to listen to me now. That's okay. I know that better than you. I'm not in it for now.
No, I don't understand.
I'm in it for...
I was in your position in an earlier time.
I'm in it... I think one of the things that American politics is about, it's a series of appointments. You have meetings at various moments in history. And unlike European politics, people talk about how the Americans have the permanent campaign. Every democracy has a permanent campaign. The difference between the United States and Britain, in Britain, you know who the leaders are, you just don't know when the election will be. In America, you know when the election will be, you just don't know who the leaders are. So there's an appointment in November of 2010, and they're not going to listen to me then. And there's an appointment in November 2012, and I highly doubt they will listen to me then. But they will listen to me between 2012 and 2014. And if not between 2012 and 2014, then certainly between 2014 and 2016. And I eat right, and I wear seatbelts. So I plan to be there. But look, I mean, this goes back to this question about Obama and McCain. Obama, I basically agree that barring a catastrophic mistake, there was nothing that John McCain could have done to win the election, nothing that any Republican who was likely to be nominated could have done to win the election. But there were things that the Democratic nominee could have done to lose the election. That was possible in those last 6 or 8 weeks. That if a Democrat had mishandled the crisis, I think there was an opportunity to lose. And I am not sure that Hillary Clinton would not have stumbled into that opportunity, because I think she... she just doesn't have it in her fingertips. There's a kind of, that being a great politician is more like being a great artist than it is like being a great intellectual. A lot of it is knowing without even being able to tell people how you know what you know. So the great politicians, the Roosevelts, the Reagans, we'll see Barack Obama, but more Barack Obama than Hillary Clinton, they just have a kind of feeling in their fingertips of what to do. They know it before the polls come in. He projected what the country wanted to see most, which is calm, reassurance, and the certainty that I have a plan. No one was quite interested in what the plan was, especially since it was obvious that John McCain had no plan or nine plans, which is even worse. Now, that said, having established his authority with that kind of presentation of calm and in command, he now has to deliver that kind of presidency. And what we're seeing is a presidency of very big gambles. And I don't think that economics as we know it suggests these gambles are going to work. They will work in the short run. I have no doubt that the stimulus will work in the way John Maynard Keynes promised when he said, in the long run, we are all dead. What he meant is, in the short run, these things work. But if in 2014 and 2015 we have 7% inflation, if in 2014, 2015 the dollar is trading at a big discount to the euro, if we see that the economy is growing not at the 3.5% that it grew between 1995 and 2005, but at the 2% that was the norm in the 1970s, if youth unemployment remains high because there are a lot of barriers to hiring new employees, there's a lot more regulation and a lot more unionization. I think at that point he will have a big problem because the country voted for a solution. They didn't vote for a specific plan. They voted to make things better. So your responsibility is to make things better. And he's doing some things that will work in the short run, but he's using this moment to make a lot of changes that are very different from the Clinton economic agenda and are therefore, since they're different policies from Bill Clinton's, are going to have different results from Bill Clinton's.
I can't let go. What barrier in unionization exists when we have less than 7%?
Where we'll be in 2015.
We'll have a level of unionization that will be barriers for young people
we'll
to be employed?
If we do.
If we do.
And other kinds of regulatory measures. If you have, for example, much higher minimum wages. There are a lot of things you can do to regulate where you protect, and this is the way it works in Europe. You protect insiders at the expense of outsiders.
We're
and that
so
is what.
So two things. Just quickly, two things.
If that doesn't happen, if he doesn't do it, then it won't have the results.
He
if he does
do it.
Wait a minute, Peter. Maria, and then we'll go to Peter.
The facts are the private sector is 7 or 8% unionization. Okay, it's incredibly low. And there are innumerable academic studies as to the fact that raising the minimum wage does not, in fact...
There are no good ones. We're going to have a bigger public sector, and that's where unionization is strong. If we have a much bigger federally subsidized transportation sector, if these high-speed rail lines are built, and if they are done, and if they have a lot of public sector employees, there will be a higher level of unionization. And public sector unionization matters to the overall life chances of young people too.
We've all agreed that Obama came into office in the midst of what is an obvious crisis. The American system is rigged against substantial domestic policy achievements normally, and usually those achievements come in the face of crisis. The New Deal being an example, the Great Society after Kennedy's assassination, and so forth. So is the stage set for Obama to have a truly consequential, substantial presidency of domestic policy achievement? David, you've sort of said the key decisions have already been made, but Theda, you have advocated a more ambitious agenda, certainly. Is this the kind of crisis situation that can lead to the rare burst of substantial domestic policy achievement? Or
let's get something straight. I mean, what I'm talking about is not all that ambitious. It's recognizing that there have been profound deteriorations in access to opportunity and basic security, not just for the working class, but for most of the population who aren't in the top fifth over the last period. There is broad public support, far ahead of Washington and public opinion, for addressing the issue of health security and controlling costs in the healthcare system. The stage is set for, and Obama's tactics are subtle and deft and designed to avoid many of the mistakes of the 1,342-page Clinton plan that I carry into my classes to show how big and incomprehensible it was. But will this initiative, and this is probably the most important one that's coming up soon beyond the economic recovery measures, will it get through Congress without being gutted by a whole series of special interests? People act as if the debate in America is between big government and the market. That debate about big government was conceded by the so-called conservatives long ago. What they want in the Republican Party and parts of the Democratic Party, in my opinion, is big government that hands out guaranteed profits, regulatory advantages, and all kinds of opportunities for special perks to the privileged interests. And these privileged interests are not all Republicans. Many of them are inside the Democratic Party in the Senate. One little example, higher education finance. Obama is proposing to cut the guaranteed profits handed to banks for simply passing through public money to loans for students and use the savings to fund more Pell Grants and publicly offered loans to lower class and middle class students. That's an important challenge for this country because access to higher education has deteriorated steadily for the last 20 years in a country that was the world leader in combining excellence and opportunity in higher education. But he's facing opposition, not so much from the Republican Party, which is off talking about succession. He's facing opposition from Democratic senators tied to those bankers who want those guaranteed profits. That's just one of many examples, and I don't know whether he'll be able to overcome that opposition if we continue to have a political system in which not just a majority, but 60 votes are required to do anything of any significance in our democracy.
You would not say that substantial health care reform is an ambitious agenda? It seems to me it's pretty ambitious.
I do not think it is at all ambitious in relationship to the deteriorating situation and the rising costs. The boldest things that happen, and this was true of the New Deal of the 1930s, are often reassertions of long-standing values in the face of deteriorating circumstances. Obama is a master of that. He is not some wild-eyed radical, either in his personal style or in the way he talks about values. He is looking for a way to reinvent an America of opportunity and broad security. And it's a reinvention. It's not some wild departure from our best traditions.
Well, it feels like a reinvention, though.
Oh, wait a minute.
Well, I mean, it does feel like a reinvention. And Republicans have their own, they have their constituents and they have their legitimate concerns about raising taxes, increasing spending, building debt. I mean, these are big, major concerns, and we don't really know where it leads. I mean, the bottom line, anytime I ask anyone, and I talk to economists and people in Congress, I say, but this model, if we project into the future, I mean, somebody sort of figured it out, right? It's going to work, and how we're going to end up in such and such a place. And the answer is always, well, nobody really knows. I mean, nobody really knows how it's going to turn out. So it could turn out badly. And, Republicans do have alternative ideas, which are worth debate.
What are they?
Well, I mean, just as an example. Yeah. No, I hear you. On health, they're going to have a plan next month, right? But philosophically, they have an ideal, which is that why not go, instead of rebuilding this healthcare system and having this government insurance policy, why not have, why not involve ourselves in entitlement reform and try to reduce the cost of health by, for example, limiting defensive medical procedures? I mean, things like that are alternatives. In principle, I don't know, but again, I mean, who knows? I'll just give you one example.
This isn't radical.
My own recent experience, this is I can't give you statistics, but I can tell you that I went to the doctor. I had an electrocardiogram. They said, oops, you're going to have a heart attack. I said, oh, really, when? And they said, anytime now, we're going to put you in an ambulance, put you in the hospital. I said, well, can I get my husband to come pick me up? They said, yes, but you can't leave the office. Oh. They put me in the hospital. The doctor comes and says, they were going to do a catheterization first thing in the morning. So they tortured me all night, you know how they do. taking my blood and checking my pulse and blah, blah, blah. The doctor said, let's just do a stress test first. Let's go easy on this. The stress test showed, yeah, your heart is weird, but that's normal for you. They sent me home. So I was in the hospital for less than 24 hours. The cost of my hospital bill was $9,000. All they did was take my temperature, take my blood, wake me up every hour, and put me on a treadmill. So something's wrong there.
Well, that's why Obama's talking about controlling costs. He recognizes that.
Go ahead, David.
This may be in a presidency with a lot of gambles. This may be the biggest gamble yet that Obama is making, because his health. We don't have his health plan yet, but his health concepts want to do two things. He wants to extend insurance to include most, if not all, of the currently uninsured, some tens of millions of people, maybe 40 million people, maybe more. At the same time, all of his projections all are predicated on the idea that he is going to be able to slow the increase in healthcare costs and by some very dramatic numbers. Now, back in the 80s, David Stockman used to have this thing called the magic asterisk. Whenever there was a problem with the Reagan budget, you'd put an asterisk there, and then the asterisk said savings to be identified. But in the Reagan years, the magic asterisk was talking about amounts in the billions and tens of billions of dollars. Obama's magic asterisks are for hundreds of billions and half trillions of dollars over the next 5 and 10 years. So when I suggest, not advise Democrats, but when I suggest that they're on a plan that is going to lead to much lower productivity growth, higher inflation, and lower job opportunities, those are the kinds of huge numbers that are hanging over the American economy. I think I can probably guess how Obama will reconcile those contradictions. And it's not completely impossible that it will work. But there's a third element of the healthcare problem, which I think does complicate it, which is that one of the other things he sort of implicitly promised to people is, yes, it's going to be more widely available, and it's not going to cost much more. In fact, it's going to cost less, and it's going to be no worse in quality. And that last element is the one that is going to be the hardest to deliver. And if, again, that...
Not really, because a lot of procedures are wasteful.
When it's your
afraid of being sued, so he put me in the hospital.
Exactly, and you're insured.
When it's your heart that is maybe having the attack, and they say this procedure is probably wasteful, and therefore we won't do it.
Do you know how many people face that circumstance and die?
It's going to be a lot more.
What would you do about the 45 million uninsured, David?
What would
your party do?
I think the Republican answer, and the Republicans don't have a good answer to this, because
they don't.
Well, wait, let him answer.
But the Republican answer begins by trying to reinstitute market disciplines through the healthcare system by bringing together the place where the money is paid and the place where the decision is made. And if for example you were John McCain, and this was not a plan, it was just a concept, that was one of the things that did him in. But his idea of a tax credit that would basically cash out what your employer is giving you now and put that money into your hands to allow you to begin to make choices and then to encourage, I like some of the ideas that Bob Bennett of Utah has, to encourage insurance companies to try to sign up people one by one rather than employers one by one. That offers hope, only hope, of instituting market discipline. What Obama's going to...
We've already tried stuff like that, and it really doesn't, because healthcare markets don't work like...
But what Obama's going to rely on instead is the monopsonistic power of government to do this from the center. He has to. There's no way that... I mean, it's the only way that makes sense of all the things he says he wants to do. And that is going to put Americans on a course where some Americans will benefit. Some people will get better health care, but others will get worse. And the group that will get worse are the people where the Democrats have made the biggest gains in recent years.
Let Maria get in.
I just want to say on the health care piece, full disclosure, I represent a couple of health insurance companies. So I will simply say this. One of the reasons that we're in the bind that we are, which is we have a very built-up employer-based system, is actually unionization. Because when unions had sufficient density, employers, they insisted on health care and retirement, and employers started to offer it, and non-union employers offered the same in order to compete. So we've built up an employer-based system And yet we've now reduced unionization. That's a different issue. And so it means we can't start from scratch, right? And we certainly learned from 1994 that the 1,000-page isn't going to work. So it is a challenge for how do you bridge, how do you move to an individual mandate in a way that doesn't disrupt what's already there, but in fact increases the coverage, reduces costs, and ensures quality. This is not an easy, and part of it is in our market-based, employer-based, for-profit system, we ended up devising a system that reimbursed on the basis of activity. Every doctor visit, every procedure, every operation, every hospitalization. So there are perverse incentives built in that add up to the cost. So we've got to figure out how to take that out without sacrificing quality.
You make a profit in the present system by excluding sick people.
Right.
And it is very important to keep in mind that after 15 years of an imperfect start, Medicare does a better job of controlling costs and delivering quality care per dollar than most of the private employer health insurance system does at this time. I don't think any of this is easy. I really agree that it's not easy. I don't think how to pay for it is as big a problem as David does, but part of the answer is to return the contribution that privileged Americans like all of us sitting at this table are making through our taxes to roughly the level it was under Ronald Reagan. That's part of the answer, and I would like to see that answer put out first before we start talking about all of the other things. And Barack Obama was amazing in the last election because he's the first national politician who consistently talked about the need to ask for greater tax contributions from the wealthy and did not run for cover at the first whiff of complaint in the media.
If you watched the Sunday morning shows this Sunday, you saw David Gregory trying to ask Larry Summers, will you guarantee that there will be no tax increase on the bottom 95%? And that question was asked to Larry Summers three different times.
Summers' job to answer questions like that.
No, except the problem is if you know Larry, you can see he knows the answer to that question. And with his brilliant mathematical mind, which is he's a mathematical mind, not a verbal mind, as he struggled to find some way not to answer that question in a way that betrayed that he knew that the answer to the question, you are not going to fund what Barack Obama wants to do with the level of tax increase
that he's talking about.
Let Maria go, and then Kathleen, go ahead.
I just want to go to this point about broader community and value, because underlying this battle we're having in ideology, one of the things we need to recognize that over the last 40 years, starting with the Reagan presidency, was a heightened focus on individualism. And I think a destruction of a sense of community. It's reached a point where you can have someone who's making $80,000 a year, right? $120,000 a year, who says, the government doesn't do anything for me. It only worries about the very rich or the very poor. And so I don't want my taxes increased. To which I had to say to this sister of mine, oh, by the way, who paid for your college education at UCLA? Because California, 25 years ago, actually had a system in which we taxed each other to have the best university system, the best state college system, the best community college system, as well as K-12. So we've destroyed our sense of community, and it's a challenge as to whether one president can help restore that.
Wait a minute. Before we go on to something else, wait a minute. Time out just a second. before we go on to something else, Kathleen, do you want to jump in on this?
Well, no, I'm from the South, so we never interrupt.
Okay. Sorry. I want to go back to
Wait. She said was she didn't want to interrupt, and then she got cut off.
You
the poor woman.
Wait a second. That ideological statement.
Wait a second.
With the fact that President Obama's plan.
We'll go.
President Obama's
plan. No, just a moment. David, wait a second.
The only thing I was going to say, I was going to agree with David.
What has he said that you're agreeing with?
Well, I think the taxes are going to go up for everyone in the second term, in Obama's second term, because, by the way, all of us baby boomers are going to, all of us, assuming that we don't have to keep working forever, they're going to be retiring in vast numbers, and we simply can't afford not to raise taxes on everyone. And that the understanding among those who know such things is that in the second term, assuming there is one, and presumptively there is, we're all going to be paying more taxes.
You know, it's a very different thing if the first thing that happens is that the very wealthy who have escaped taxes increasingly start paying their share, and then others are asked to pitch in. And it's a very different thing, and Americans, I've studied this, come on, Americans will support paying taxes for programs we all have a stake in. And the example is Social Security.
Right.
And when average income Americans say, government hasn't paid much attention to me, they've paid much more attention to the very rich and the very poor, they're right on the whole.
But they are
President
right.
Obama does not believe with you. Because
he wants to change government does.
Because if he did, he would not say the contrary, which is what he's been saying for the past
few
months.
No. He has never said that he won't raise taxes in his second term. He's never said
that. Well, he's going to get his programs in place, and people presumably will be happy enough with them that
they'll
be willing to
cough
it up.
A little history. In his first term in office, President Bush passed the third biggest tax cut since the war. Adopted the most dramatic education initiative since the middle 1960s, introduced the first permanent new social welfare program since 1974, overthrew the Taliban, overthrew Saddam Hussein, and presided over the beginning of what then looked like the greatest expansion in the financial wealth of Americans since the 1920s. By any definition, that was an enormously successful first term. I don't think it's going to go down in history as an enormously successful presidency. And I would caution those who are urging President Obama to think about a successful first term, to remember, can we, in a university environment, invoke the classics, to remember that great line of Herodotus's, count no man happy until he is dead. A president who tries for a successful first term will have a very unhappy second term. This is a very long-term game. It is played in decades. And President Obama should be much more focused on how he can make his administration seem successful to the Americans of the year 2028 than to the Americans of the year 2012.
Oh, I think he is. He's a very strategic president and politician.
And we end then getting Theda and David to agree, actually. So my thanks to Theda Scotchpole, Kathleen Parker, Maria Teveste, David Frum. Thank you. Good night.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.